Okay.
Okay.
Go for it.
Have a seat, please. People quiet, thank you. Entertain a motion to come back into regular session for public hearings from our recess.
So moved.
Second.
Motion, Mrs. Deaver, second. Mr. Phillips, any questions on the motion? Take the vote, Mrs. Deaver.
Yes.
Cole.
Yes.
Phillips.
Yes.
Wilson.
Yes.
Oh, yes, motion carried. Now time for our 1:30 public hearings. Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Mr. President, and I will review the rules of procedure for our County Council zoning hearings. When the Council holds these hearings on zoning applications, they are legislative hearings because Council uses the information obtained during the hearings to decide whether to adopt an ordinance to amend a comprehensive zoning map in the manner requested by the applicant. Each application will be announced. The Director, Mr. Lank, will review with Council the minutes and testimony from the planning zoning hearing, and those minutes will be made part of the record along with any exhibits introduced at the planning and zoning hearing and any recommendation made by the Commission. The applicant will be called on to present and explain their application and present reasons supporting their application. Council may question the applicant and their witnesses. After the applicant has presented their application, Council will provide an opportunity for anyone else who favors the application to speak. After that, any persons who oppose or question the application will be allowed to state the reasons for their opposition or questions. After that, there will be no rebuttal by the applicant, and the hearing will be closed unless Council decides to leave the record open for a specific purpose and time period. Further, the applicant will not be allowed to question persons who speak in opposition, and persons who speak in opposition will not be allowed to question the applicant or their witnesses. If you intend to speak, you're required to come to the front and stand at the speaker stand and state your name and home address before you make a statement. We also have a sign-in sheet at the speaker stand, and please sign and give your address on that sheet. If you represent or speak for a group or organization, please identify who you represent. When you make your statement, please be concise. Do not repeat yourself. If you have a written statement, hand it to Mr. Lank, and it will be made part of the record. If there is more than one witness for the applicant or more than one person in opposition, please do not repeat points that a prior speaker has already stated. With this many people, I know there's going to be a lot of people that would like to speak. And again, I'll request that you do not repeat points that a prior speaker has already stated. All persons in attendance should conduct themselves in an orderly fashion. No applause or other disruptive behavior is permitted. If you have a cell phone, pager, beeper, or other telephonic device with you, please take time now to turn it off or switch it to silent service. At the conclusion of the hearing on each application, Council may either approve it, deny it, or defer it to a later date. If the Planning and Zoning Commission deferred action, Council will do likewise. It has been pointed out to me that because of the large crowd, we are nearing our capacity for fire marshal regulations. Please keep all the doors clear. Do not stand in front of or block any doors. Thank you. Mr. Lank, the first application today is conditional use number 1955, filed on behalf of the state of Delaware.
Yes, thank you. This is an application for the state of Delaware, more specifically DelDOT, to consider the conditional use of land in an AR1 agriculture residential district for a DelDOT maintenance yard to be located on a certain parcel of land lying and being in Northwest 400, Sussex County, on a parcel containing 30 acres more or less and lying north of Newton Road, also known as Route 404A, and east of the railroad, and being identified as tax map ID 5-30, map 16, parcel number 11.01. Planning and Zoning Commission held a public hearing on this application on January 24th of 2013. During that public hearing, we did receive comments from the County Engineering Department Utility Planning Division. Edwin Tenefoss was present on behalf of DelDOT and gave testimony. There were no parties present in support of or in opposition to the application. At the conclusion of the public hearing, the Commission discussed the application Mr. Smith stated he would move that the commission recommend approval of conditional use number 1955 for the state of Delaware, more specifically DelDOT, for a maintenance yard based upon the record and for the following reasons. One, the applicant stated that the need is of a public nature and promotes the health, safety, and general welfare of the public. No parties appeared in opposition. Two, the application with the following conditions placed upon it will not have an adverse impact on traffic or the surrounding properties. A, the entrance shall be secured by a gate when the maintenance yard is not in use. B, one lighted sign not to exceed 48 square feet per side shall be permitted. C, any dumpster pad shall be screened from view and shown on the final site plan. D, days and hours of operation shall be Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. to 3 p.m., except as emergency conditions dictate. E, any security lighting shall be downward focused so as to not impact neighboring properties. F, areas designated for parking shall be shown on the final site plan and shall be clearly marked on the site. And G, the final site plan shall be subject to the review and approval of the Planning and Zoning Commission. There was a motion by Mr. Smith, seconded by Mr. Ross, carried unanimously to forward this application to the council with a recommendation that the application be approved for the reasons and with the conditions stated. And that motion carried 5-0. For benefit of council, I passed down copies of the site plan for this application. I received no additional comments from any agency or individual to date on this application.
Any questions from council? If not, can the applicant come forward and make your presentation? I see some staring in the back of the room. Is the applicant here?
Here he comes.
Here he is.
He got blocked out of the room.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking. I should have planned ahead and gotten here before the crowd.
You should have planned ahead. That says something, doesn't it?
I guess that was poor wording on my part. My name is Edwin Tenafoss. I'm with DelDOT. On behalf of the Department of Transportation, again, Mr. Lank pretty much summarized everything. We are looking to create a new maintenance yard on this piece of property. Our existing it's to replace the existing maintenance yard that we currently have in Seaford. For several reasons, one, our Seaford yard has issues with flooding, and we've also need additional room for material storage at that site. And also, this particular site will allow for better use, or we're more centralized for our service of the district, of their area too that they serve. They're more centralized, so they're better able to meet the needs of that district, and then also it allows us for the railroad access in the future if we decide that if it were to become more beneficial to get our material storage via the railroad. The actual, we are not actually increasing the number of employees. The employees that are based in Seaford will be moving up to this location. There will not be additional employees added necessarily at this point, but basically this is to replace our Seaford yard. With that,
so are you saying the Seaford spot is going to be closed?
Yes, okay, that's correct. Okay.
So there's
at least it will not be manned any longer.
Okay.
So whether they sell it or do something with it, we will not be necessarily using that site for anything in particular.
Thank you.
Any other questions from council?
I could ask him what's wrong with it, but I won't.
Any questions from council? Did you have any other witnesses that you would like to present?
No, I don't.
Is there anyone else here today that would like to speak in favor of this application? Anyone else in favor? Seeing none, is there anyone here that would like to speak in opposition to this application? Anyone here today that would like to speak in opposition? Seeing none, at this point, Mr. President, this public hearing can be closed, and if it's the council's desire to close the public record on this.
We will close the public hearing, and anybody okay with closing public comment? Okay.
Thank
close public hearing, close public comment. Thank you for your time. Mr. Moore, read the short title.
Okay, this is an ordinance grant of conditional use of land in an AR1 agricultural residential district for DelDOT Maintenance Yard to be located on a certain parcel of land lying and being in the northwest 400 Sussex County, containing 30 acres more or less, tax map ID 5-30-16-11.01, along with the conditions that were contained in page 2 of the council handout, and it's read by Mr. Lank and numbered A through G.
Pleasure, council.
I'll move that it be approved.
Second.
Motion, Mrs. Deaver, second. Mr. Cole, to approve conditional use 1955 with the
conditions
as listed. Any questions on the motion? Take the vote, Mrs. Deaver.
Yes, and taking the advice, good advice, of Planning and Zoning Commission, and not only that, but their vote was 5-0. So I feel very confident in this one.
Mr. Cole.
I'll vote yes, same reasons.
Mr. Phillips.
I'll vote yes. It's obviously needed, according to them, and with Planning and Zoning's recommendation.
Mr. Wilson.
I vote yes, pardon P&Z.
I also, with Planning and Zoning recommendations, I agree with their findings. I'll vote yes, motion carried.
Okay.
More.
Thank you. And the next two matters, we have two matters that I would suggest, as the Planning and Zoning did, holding the public hearing on both at the same time. Obviously, at such times we have to take action, they would be acted on separately. The first is change of zone 1725, and the second would be conditional use number 1951, both applied for by Jack Lingo Asset Management, LLC. Mr. Lang?
Yes, change of zone number 1725 is the application of Jack Lingo Asset Management, LLC, to amend the comprehensive zoning map from GR, General Residential District, to AR1, Agriculture Residential District, to be located on a certain parcel of land lying and being in Lewis and Rehoboth 100, Sussex County, containing 74 acres more or less, lying southwest of Ward Road, being Road 283A, and southeast of Cedar Grove Road, being Road 283, and also being 2,400 feet southwest of Marbury Knoll Road, also referred to as Road 284, and being identified as a part of tax map ID 334, map 12, parcel 16. Conditional use number 1951 is the application of Jack Lingo Asset Management, LLC, to consider the conditional use of land in an AR1 agriculture residential district for an RV resort and campground to be located on a certain parcel of land lying and being in Lewis and Rehoboth 100, Sussex County, on a parcel containing 162.424 acres more or less, lying southeast of Ward Road, again being Road 283A, and southeast of Cedar Grove Road, being Road 283, and also being 2,400 feet southwest of Marbury Knoll Road, being Road 284, and identified as part of tax map ID 33412, map 12, parcel 16. Now, this application was also reviewed during public hearing on January 24th of 2013. And in that public hearing process, as stated by Mr. Moore, it was noted that the applications were being combined for the purpose of public hearing so that the records did not have to be duplicated and that the commission would make a decision on each application independently, as will be what the council will do also. In the public record, the applicants did provide an exhibit booklet on January 14th, 2013, and that is a part of the record and has been since January 14th of 2013. We heard comments from the County Engineering Department Utility Planning Division. The file was reviewed and information was provided to council at the close of business on that January 24th, and we had received 9 letters in support and 528 signatures on petitions in opposition, and 111 letters and emails were received in opposition. Those letters, just for informational and not including all projects, but a good majority, were letters from Ward Road area, the retreat at Love Creek, Briarwood Estates, Hart's Landing, Webb's Landing, the Plantations, Sandy Bray, Henlopen Landing, the Bayfront subdivision, Marbury Knoll, and many others, and many individuals also. Nick Hammonds, the project manager, was present on behalf of Jack Lingo Asset Management, LLC, with Gene Byard, attorney with Morris James Wilson, Halbrook and Byard Professional Association, Ring Lardner, professional engineer, DJ Hughes, professional engineer, and Mike Wigley, architect, all of Davis, Bowen, and Friedel, and all gave testimony about the project. Mary Scriber Fox was present on behalf of the Retreat of Low Creek Homeowners Association. Ms. Fox is an attorney with Steen Whaler and Shriver Fox Professional Association and gave testimony in opposition. There were 18 parties who spoke individually on behalf of themselves and their home or their homeowners association during the public hearing. Some of those parties provided their written comments at the conclusion of their testimony. At the conclusion of the public hearing, the commission asked for a show of hands for those parties present in support of the application, those parties present in opposition. There were no parties other than the representatives of the application present in support. There were at least 110 parties present in opposition. It was noted that there were some parties that already left the chambers, so the number was just approximate. At the conclusion of the public hearing, the commission discussed these public hearings. There was a motion on change of zone 1725 by Mr. Johnson, seconded by Mr. Smith, and carried unanimously to defer action for further consideration, to leave the record open for 15 days after the announcement of receipt of DLDOT's comments on the traffic impact study and any other written comments. And that motion carried 5-0. In reference to conditional use 1951, there was another motion by Mr. Johnson, seconded by Mr. Smith, and carried unanimously to defer action for further consideration and again to leave the record open for 15 days after the announcement of the receipt of DLDOT comments on the traffic impact study and any other written comments. And that motion carried 5-0.
Did they get the DLDOT comments?
No, not. We haven't received that yet. So the record's still open.
The record is still open under planning and zoning.
Mm-hmm. Just for the record, in the record there are a letter from DLDOT in May 17 of 12 makes reference to a traffic impact study being given consideration. They have not yet responded. On August 20th of 2012, we received the Office of State Planning Coordination comments in reference to the Preliminary Land Use Service, also known as PLUS Review, on July 25th of 2012. On October 8th of 2012, Davis, Bowen, and Friedel Incorporated responded to the PLUS comments. On October 23rd of 2012, the Office of State Planning Coordination forwarded a copy of the Davis, Bowen, and Friedel response, which we'd already received. On January 14th of 2013, Davis, Bowen, and Friedel provided an environmental assessment and public facilities evaluation report. On January 24th of 2013, Department of Natural Resources letter was received on behalf of Secretary Colin O'Mara. In reference to the many letters that we received, I spent a few hours last night trying to count all these letters. It was a lot.
I think I have some that I haven't probably sent in.
I received some today,
right,
too. I received quite a few today. Okay. Prior to January 24th of 2013, we'd receive 8 letters in support, 115 letters in opposition, 531 petition signatures in opposition. And since the public hearing, rather than give you a total of a lot of numbers, the total now is 11 support letters, 252 letters in opposition, and those letters include either letters or emails, mostly emails. And the total petition signatures is 814. I will say that some of those letters and emails and petitions are duplications because they went to different parties. We tried to separate them as best we could. Mm-hmm. And because the person that signed wrote a letter might have also signed a petition. So the numbers are, the real number is 814 people in opposition. So So there is some duplication. They're received from different sources. Some came from council members, some came from administrative staff, and the remainders either came through direct mail to my office, hand-delivered, or emails. I received no additional comments from any agencies to date, and that's all I have, Mr. Moore, unless you have questions.
Any questions from council?
I have a question of our council. Some of the folks mentioned to me that Planning and Zoning had asked them to sign up. All the folks that came to the hearing were asked to sign up. We're not, I imagine we're going to count hands, too.
What happens on sign-up on Planning and Zoning hearings, people are asked to sign in as they come in because it's after hours.
Oh.
And people come in and
out
sign.
The hall.
But there was, yes, but there is a count, there was a count taken as well. I suspect that the council may want to do the same.
I just wanted to know how we would proceed.
Well, we did do the count a little bit later at the end of the meeting, and there were some parties had left, and they may have been in support or opposition. We don't know, but the numbers are still pretty close to being accurate, and it's a plus or minus anyway.
At what point might I ask for some information about how much GR we have in the county? When would it be appropriate for me to ask for that of Planning and Zoning? I just realize that that may be important.
It would be. You could ask that now.
I didn't want to put him on the spot.
I doubt if he has a number on his fingertips.
Yeah.
But
I'm just wondering, you know, because we would be losing it, and I'm wondering where that would leave us at that point. So, yes, could I get an idea of how much GR we have in the county at this time?
No.
No.
The GR districts were established in 1971 with the adoption of the map for the zoning map, and the purpose of GR was to allow for areas for people to develop single-family lots for either a site-built house, a modular-type construction, or a mobile home, or a double-wide.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's a small percentage countywide. It's probably less than 1% if you go to total acreage.
Okay.
But it's if you looked at the map, it's a certain color. It'd be certain areas, and it's scattered all throughout the county, trying to create a balance.
It's only maybe how many acres do you think, if you had to give a rough number?
No idea. I really don't.
We haven't increased any. If anything, it's gotten smaller, wouldn't you say?
We've had a substantial amount of acreage in GR was reduced to AR1 for the purpose of agriculture preservation, because originally when the Agriculture Land Preservation Foundation started, it had to be an AR agriculture area.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the GR was removed, some of the commercial was removed to allow people to apply for perpetual maintenance and ag districts.
All right, so there probably isn't a whole lot then.
It's still substantial acre, but it's
there
not
is
major.
Substantial
it's not major when you consider the whole majority of the counties, they are.
Mm-hmm. Right, okay. All right, thank you very much.
Any other questions from council?
Robin, just to make sure, the letters that were sent to us, you have entered those in public record? Okay, thank you.
Can I add something real quick?
Certainly.
I have a banker box sitting beside me here, and half the banker box is letters. And it's all, I wasn't about to try to copy them all. It's available to the council. The majority of the public here has seen some of the letters, and it's always available to the public. It's public record.
Sure.
Thank you. If there are no other questions, send Mr. Byard.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Gene Byard, for the record. I represent the applicant, Jack Lingo Asset Management. With me this afternoon are Nick Hammonds, principal in Jack Lingo Asset Management, Zach Crouch, DJ Hughes, Ring Lardner, and Mike Wigley from Davis, Bowen, and Friedel, the project engineers, and Ed Lene, the project's environmental consultant. To begin, I wanted to point out the reason for the application for the change of zone, and it's very simple. Although mobile home subdivisions and mobile home parks are permitted as a matter of right in a GR zone, an RV park and a campground is not. The only zoning classification where an RV park and campground may be placed is AR. That's the reason for the application. I'd like to go to the board and take counsel on a tour of the neighborhood.
Mr. Byard, we have really come up in the technical world. We're giving you a...
In green is the property, approximately 162 acres of a 325-acre farm. The nearest immediate residential subdivision is Briarwood Estates, which was created in the 80s. It is served by private well and septic. Hart's Landing is further south toward Route 24. To the north is Ward Road. There is some scattered housing there and along Cedar Grove Road, distance of probably 4,000 feet to the entrance of a development created in 2003 called the Retreat at Love Creek. I'll come back to the map in a minute. The only zoning activity within a half mile of the applicant's property in the last 10 years has been the application of Charles Moore for his coastal towing business. He applied to change the zoning of his property from GR to AR with a conditional use so he could open his towing business in his garage. That property is right there. The only other zoning application in the last 10 years was the application of Caldera Properties to develop the Retreat at Love Creek in 2003. That was an application to change the zoning of that property from AR1 to MRRPC, thus reducing the minimum lot size for that development from 20,000 square feet to 7,500 square feet, raising the possibility the density of that development could be more than doubled. That application was one of the rare ones where both PLUS and DENREC disapproved of the project, and the Department of Agriculture asked that the project be turned down. As with this project, DelDOT did not require a traffic impact study. The only other zoning activity in the immediate area is the property right here. That is zone B1. I'm guessing it's about an acre. That was rezoned and became what was known as Billy's. For those of you who go back a number of years, Billy's was a local bar and tap room that closed a number of years ago. Now, within a radius of 1 mile, there is considerable residential development activity ongoing. The Love Creek Landing cluster subdivision is this property right here on the western shore of Love Creek. That's 183 lots. To the north, at the headwaters of Love Creek, is what's called the Marine Farm, now called the Coastal Club. That's a 630-lot residential subdivision. Going east on Robinsonville Road, the property now is known as Shepherd's Walk. That's a 92-lot residential subdivision. All of those projects have received preliminary subdivision approval, and the Marine Farm, or the Coastal Club, has approval for phase one. Whether those projects are going to be built, I can't say in this economy, but those three alone total more than 900 residential lots within a mile of this property. That's the area. I'd ask Nick to come forward and identify himself.
Hello, Council. Nick Hammonds with Jack Lingo Asset Management.
Nick, your credentials are in the record, but let me ask one question. You are a licensed Delaware realtor?
Yes, I am.
I'll start you out with asking you a simple question. Can you explain the evolution of the idea that came to be Love Creek RV Park and Campground?
Yes, and that's exactly what I'd like to do today. I thought I'd start by talking a little bit about the property. It's one that's been in the J.G. Townsend family for quite some time now, and one that was identified as a property that they wanted to develop in the near term. So the first step in any property is a feasibility analysis, and we started with the infrastructure that was in place, and specifically utilities. Electric and water were in the area and were not a problem. Sewer was one that took a little bit of exploration, and after completing a capacity study and several meetings with the county, it was determined that we would be able to annex into the Sussex County Sewer District, building a pump station on our property and a force main out to Plantations Road. With that, we also will be creating an additional 8080 to use for those on Ward Road. If they so choose to be served by Central Sewer, they will be able to hook up as well. The next thing that we did was to take a look at our options for the property and our by right options. As mentioned previously, 74 of the 162 plus or minus acres are zoned GR. And by right, using the 10,000 square foot lot calculation, we could do up to 322 units and by right mobile homes. The balance of the property is zoned AR1, 88 acres, using the 20,000 square foot lot calculation.
They would have to be mobile homes?
They wouldn't have to be.
No, I misunderstood. Okay. I thought you said they would have to be.
No. The 88 acres using the 20,000 square foot lot calculation would yield an additional 191 units. So in total, you're looking roughly at between 510 and 515 units. Obviously, the other avenue we explored was that of an RV park and this conditional use before you today. This has been an idea that's been kicked around for a little while now, given the success and seeming need for more RV sites in the area. I think if you look at many of the well-located sites in the area, they all are at or very close to capacity. Coupled with the fact that in 2006, a very successful campground or RV park called the Three Seasons was shut down and left a void of 330 units, we felt that this was an opportune time to bring more RV sites to the area. The initial feasibility analysis showed that the idea did have some merit, and if we were going to move forward with this, we thought this property provided a lot of what we wanted: the natural habitat with wooded cover, the proximity to Love Creek, and proximity, obviously, to the beaches and shopping. So the next step for us was to contact Davis Bone and Friedel and start working on a conceptual plan for the property. We got the initial iterations of that back, and we're very excited about what we saw. Made some edits to that based on things that we had learned, and ultimately had a plan that we were comfortable with. We then sent that plan out to a nationally acclaimed campground or RV park consultant out of Austin, Texas, who's done work in the U.S. and abroad, and he was able to implement some best demonstrated practices from parks around the country in addressing some operational issues, things that that aren't so easy to see on the plan to the untrained eye. Things such as turning radii into the sites, turning radii, generally speaking, throughout the site, location of amenities, site situation relative to the natural topography of the site, location of the check-in, and many other ideas. After all of this had been implemented into our plan, we felt that we were ready to come before planning and zoning for the rezoning and conditional use application. We did, however, take one additional step prior to that meeting, and that was a meeting that we invited residents, many of whom I would assume are in the audience today, to a meeting at the Beacon Hotel in Lewis. I would say we had about between 80 and 100 attendees at that meeting, and the idea of the meeting was to introduce our application such that they weren't reading about it in the newspaper or seeing it via public notice and could ask questions right on the spot. There were a number of issues that were brought up at that meeting. I'd say the biggest issue was a temporary access that we showed coming off of Ward Road that was to serve the first 200 units. You will not see that on our plan today. As a result of that meeting, hearing loud and clear that was not something that those living on and around Ward Road were okay with, we eliminated that access from the plan. Additionally, there was concern over some cabins that we had located immediately on or very close to Ward Road. We have since removed those or relocated those cabins within the site to address that issue, and now have a forested buffer that totals nearly 300 feet from Ward Road to the nearest RV site. Some operational issues came up in that meeting, things such as noise and pollution, and what I'd say is our interests, and what I told everyone that evening, our interests in that regard are very much aligned. We're looking to bring a high-end, top-notch family facility to the area, and if we had noise and pollution, we wouldn't be able to attract the types of people that we want to attract. So as you can see, we made several changes after that meeting. We then came before the Planning and Zoning Commission, heard many of the same issues, specifically those relating to traffic and the environment. With respect to traffic, I won't get into too much detail, but if you look at the analysis, it will tell you a 515 plus or minus unit subdivision would generate more traffic than the seasonal campground that we are proposing. With respect to some of the environmental concerns that have come up, we will be addressing some of those, but what I will tell you is we've done everything within our power to make this an environmentally responsible application. We've included additional buffering, and like I said, our environmental consultant will get into some of his recommendations to us. So in closing, I think should we receive approval, we're going to build a high-end, highly amenitized, very family-oriented campground, one that promotes tourism in the area, one that creates jobs, both construction and ongoing operational positions. We plan to build most of the amenities up front. We're going to control the campground very tightly with rules and regulations to ensure the experience that I noted earlier that we want our campers and those living around the site to have. Again, I mentioned it will be seasonal, open from April 1st to October 31st. After October 31st, either RVs will be stored at the site or will be asked to leave the site, and all of the utilities will be cut off. We will not have any year-round residents on this site. So again, in closing, I think this is an extremely well-thought-out application and look forward to some of our consultants presenting more detail on our application.
Nick, a couple of questions for you. How will this project be phased, if it is phased?
It will be phased. The first construction phase will begin in 2014 with an opening to campers in 2015. I believe we'll probably every 2 years start a new construction phase. So 2014, 2016, and 2018 will be our construction phases, with those phases opening the following year, assuming demand dictates.
And how about your planned amenities? When will those be installed?
The vast majority of amenities will be installed up front, things such as the clubhouse, pool, fitness center, canoe and kayak launch will be installed up front, and predominantly all of the amenities will be done in the first two phases.
Thank you. Where is Mike? I'd like to introduce Ring Lardner and Mike Wigley from Davis Bowen and Friedel. Their credentials are in the record. Ring, if you will, describe the site's present condition.
Good afternoon. Currently, the site consists of, the property itself is a total of 329.64 acres. As previously mentioned, this application requests a conditional use for approximately half of that, which is 162.42 acres to be exact. We've already discussed the different variances of zoning within that and the appropriate acreage. In Exhibit 1 of the booklet is some various maps. I just wanted to point out a few of the things. The first map is the Hunter floodplain, which generally lies along Love Creek, Hetty Fisher Glade, and the unnamed tributary to that. There is a map showing the National Wetland Inventory maps. The wetlands will be discussed further on in this presentation. Another map is the sewer district and showing the proximity to this project. There's a county zoning map, of which Mr. Bird previously described the zoning, And as you'll see, of course, the zoning is surrounded on three sides by AR1 zoning. The next map after that is the state strategies map, of which you will notice that this parcel is level 2 and level 3 with some out-of-play areas. Those out-of-play areas are specifically Love Creek, Hetty Fisher Glade, and an unnamed tributary. Most of the development is within the level 2 area. There is some level 3, which will be protected with some buffers for both title and non-title, which, again, will be talked about later on. The next map is the comprehensive plan map, which shows this project being located in the environmentally sensitive developing area. And then the last map is just the map showing the conditional use as it sits on the property.
Bring you reference wetlands. Are there wetlands on site?
There are wetlands on site. There are both state and federal wetlands. They have been delineated by environmental resources, and we are currently in the process of obtaining jurisdictional determinations from both agencies.
Will any wetlands be disturbed if the project is developed?
No wetlands are proposed to be disturbed. There may be a road crossing in the upper reaches of some non-tidal wetlands, of which that disturbance has not been determined. We are such an early stage of the development and planning of this project.
Was a timber cruise performed on the site?
A timber cruise was performed on the site, and that can be found in Exhibit 6 of your booklet. The study documented various species of trees, numbers, and sizes, of which allows us to use for planning various roadway layouts, site layouts, should the project be approved and move forward into the design.
Am I correct that the emphasis is on preservation?
That is correct.
Was there a rare threatened endangered species report prepared?
There was a rare endangered threatened species report prepared by Environmental Resources, and I'll defer that to Mr. Linnae later on in the presentation.
Are there any historical or archaeological features on the site?
Yes, there are. SHPO had pointed out there is a known archaeological site near Welch's Pond. We're in the process of gathering that information from them to show on the site plan so that it will be preserved. As far as archaeological goes, there is the Pomeroy and Beers Atlas of 1868, which shows the potential for a house, the Milby House, which we believe is located actually at the property line between Coastal Towing and this property. Other houses referenced on this atlas or in other portions of the property which are not included as part of the conditional use application.
Any evidence of any Indian burial grounds on the site?
None that we have found.
Any significant stormwater issues that you foresee in design?
There are no significant stormwater. The site is very well drained with three different points of drainage for the site.
Are there any significant issues created by impervious cover?
No, there are no significant issues created by impervious cover.
As required by the Quality of Life Act, did you prepare an application and submit it to the Office of State Planning Coordination?
We did. That application was reviewed by PLUS on July 25th. We received their comments on August 20th and responded, as Mr. Lang said, on October 8th. And those responses can be found in Exhibit 2 of the booklet.
Are there any significant issues raised by the PLUS comments that have not been addressed?
The only significant issue that has not been addressed yet deals with some environmental issues, which, again, I will defer to Mr. Linnae later on this presentation to address those further.
Is this project compliant with County Ordinance 115-172?
Yes, it is.
At the Planning and Zoning Commission, someone in the audience had a question about whether cabins are permitted in this zoning classification. Do you have a position in that regard?
Yes. As stated in subparagraph 9 of Section 115-172H for parks and campgrounds, it states that all units to be used for the purpose of human habitation shall be tents, travel trailers, recreational vehicles, and equipment manufactured specifically for camping purposes.
Are the cabins that you've seen manufactured specifically for camping purposes?
Yes, they are.
Did you prepare an environmentally sensitive developing district overlay zone report?
Yes, sir, we did.
And that was filed with the Planning and Zoning Commission, as the ordinance requires?
Correct.
Were there any significant issues in that report?
No significant issues, and we are compliant as outlined in that portion of the code.
I'd ask you to stand down for a second and ask Mike to talk about the site plan, the design construction.
Thank you, Mr. Byer. Good afternoon. What I'd like to do is just spend a couple minutes talking about the site plan, walking you through it a little bit, orienting you to the project, filling you in on the layout, the amenities that are being proposed, give you some idea of how the RV resort will work. The first drawing that I have, and you should all have copies of these, and I think, Ring, you'll point out the various components that I point to here. First of all, you see the site in this context map is colored. Route 24 is running a long ways to the bottom of the page to give you some idea. The Love Creek Bridge is located right about here. So Love Creek snakes its way up and down the page over on this side. You can see Mulberry Knoll Road, Cedar Grove Road, and then Ward Road along the top of the page to give you some orientation there. Before I get into actually describing the site, what I'd like to do is give you some idea of how we're approaching the buffers for the project. Now, Mr. Lene is going to talk a little bit more about the tidal marsh and the wetlands that are involved in the project, but what I'd like to do is show you from a planning perspective the various buffers that we're also incorporating into the project. So we have non-tidal wetlands along here, so we are indicating a 50-foot non-tidal wetlands buffer, and you can see that's in that darker green color as it works around the glade.
Mike, before you go further, that's a voluntary buffer. That's not something required by county ordinance or state law.
That's correct. We also have indicated in this brighter green a 50-foot landscape buffer that is required along the property lines that adjoin other properties. In addition to that, along the various roadways, we're required to have a 100-foot campsite setback that we've incorporated. And in addition to that, we're required to have a 400-foot campsite setback from any residence that is not on this particular property. Up until the planning and zoning meeting, we were really concerned about the properties along Ward Road, and you can see the setbacks along there. It was mentioned that there might also be some concern down at the point in the southwestern corner of the property. We've since measured that. You can see the 400-foot line comes across the bottom of the site, but the nearest campsite is 500 feet away from the nearest home on that side.
Mike, what's the average buffer along Ward Road to the first campsite?
About 300 feet.
And that will be undisturbed forest?
That's correct. And that's a good segue into the actual site plan itself. So everything is oriented just as you saw before. So we have Ward Road along the top of the page. And what Mr. Byard was referring to was this wooded buffer along here. And we didn't have it that way back in the beginning. Mr. Hammonds had mentioned that at one time we actually did have an entrance, the main entrance, for the first 200 units that DelDOT was willing to accept, was going to come directly off of Ward Road. That since has been removed and relocated along Cedar Grove Road, as you can see over here. Additionally, we had cabins all along that property as well. We had our 100-foot setback, but those have been relocated. And since the planning and zoning meeting and since Mr. Lene has gone through and done an environmental study, there are also a couple other changes that we're making that you don't see yet on this plan. But this roadway, as you can see, that works its way from the Welcome Center along Welch's Pond and then back into the property, this roadway will be eliminated as well. So we'll have even additional buffer from Ward Road at that location and actually reducing pervious area to a pretty good extent with that road elimination. So if I can, I'll walk you through the site, let you know how the project works. You can see, as I mentioned, the new entrance right off of Cedar Grove Road. As with RV resorts, it's important to have a welcome center, a place where the RVers can come in and check in. This particular resort and campground will be able to accommodate towable vehicles as well as motorized vehicles that can come in, RV designations. The way it's set up is that there is a turn lane and the ability for 20 RVs and their towing vehicles to actually stack up before coming into the site. That's, I think, quite a big number. I think it's more than will be necessary. But what's important to note is, in addition to that, 8 more vehicles can be stacked, so we shouldn't have any problem at all along Cedar Grove Road with vehicles stacking up in peak periods to come into the campsite. So we have the welcome center. They check in at this location. This will be a gated and secure campsite. They'll need a card reader to be able to get in once they've checked in. There will be fencing along the perimeter. As you come into the site, you can see how the campsites themselves are set up. And we have an enlarged version of those campsites down in the bottom right-hand corner of this particular drawing. It's important to note that each of these are 40 feet wide, which is required by the zoning code. The zoning code also requires that each campsite be 2,000 square feet. We're at a minimum of 3,000 square feet. And the idea is that we're trying to create a situation, because this is a wooded site, we think that's going to be an attractive draw for RVers and campers, that we want to be able to selectively clear and keep as many specimen trees as we can for the project. And so you can see how each of these sites are set up. As Mr. Hammonds mentioned, turning radiuses are met back in. We always want the campers to be able to look over their left shoulders as they easily back in the spaces. A lot of our spaces are pulled through for convenience, so we think it's set up very much for the beginner RVer as well as a more advanced RVer, and it is set up as a family and retiree type of vacationer. You can see how the site is worked up. You'll see that there's 3 numbers, and that roughly gives you some idea of how the project may be phased. So the first phase will actually be along the point, the roughly 200 site phases. In between phase 1 and 2 is our primary amenity package. And as Mr. Hammonds mentioned, most of this will be built at the beginning during phase 1 at some point. But you can see the various amenities that are located within that central amenity area. There's a general store, for instance. There might be a little cafe or snack shop there. There'll be a swimming pool, clubhouse, fitness center, playgrounds, ball fields, and a variety of horseshoes, that type of thing that would all happen in that one central area. You can see that there are bathhouses that are intermittently spaced throughout for convenience. And you will also note that we're trying to incorporate the stormwater management features and ponds as part of the amenity complex. So trails and whatnot, you can see, will link amenities throughout the project. As you work your way further toward the point, you'll notice that there's an amphitheater chapel that we're proposing. There's been some discussion about this, but the idea is that this amphitheater would be able to accommodate maybe 100 or 150 people in terrace seating or benches. There would be maybe a grass knoll to handle overflow seating. The stage might be like 20 feet by 40 feet. It's intended really to be able to accommodate a church service or a barbershop quartet or some type of family entertainment, movies, whatnot.
And Mike, do you have a representative photograph or other rendering of what a amphitheater might look like?
I do. There's a campground called Little Bennett Campground that's in Clarksburg, Maryland. And this will give you a general idea of what this type of amphitheater would look like. And you can see that it has the what I described with the seating and the stage, and it has a small lean-to, if you will, or a covering to cover for lighting and that type of thing if there's that type of performance going on.
If council chose to look, is there any amphitheater in this area that council might view?
Well, Cape Henlopen State Park has an amphitheater.
Is that of similar size and scale?
It's about the same size in area. It's maybe not quite as detailed, but it is available as an amphitheater.
Am I correct, there's also one at Leisure Point?
I believe so.
And there. I believe at one state park. I'm not sure.
Killens Pond State Park.
Killens Pond. And And they're all similar size and scale, so far as
The one at Killens Pond's a little bit smaller, but it's the same idea, yes.
Sorry to interrupt. Back to your amenities.
Yes. So in addition to the amphitheater, you know, we're also suggesting maybe paddle boat launch in the stormwater management ponds. We have a section of the park that is designated as a premium area. It's you can see there it's got its own swimming pool amenity. As you go further toward the point, we have a canoe outfitter building. There may be storage for you know, several kayaks maybe that would be launched. And you can see on the point there is a canoe kayak launch. Mr. Lene is going to get into that a little bit more.
In that regard, Ed, there will not be any marina.
No, there will not be.
Excuse me, no. Mike. Will not be a boat ramp?
There will not be a boat ramp, no.
No power boats permitted?
No power boats at this location.
And this will not be open to the public?
That's correct. Yes, all the amenities are intended to be for the campers and their guests and for their use on site. And we do have a dock bar proposed. It's intended to be a casual gathering place, maybe up to 50 people sitting around the tiki hut type of a site. Yes, is that better?
Yeah.
Okay.
Will there be RV storage on site?
There is. If you go over to this part of the site, there's room there for about 60 RV campers that could be stored there. The idea is, in this particular section, it's all going to be fenced. So as you drive along Cedar Grove Road, you don't see those stored campers.
What about lighting, fencing, and security? Can you touch on that?
Sure, yes. As I mentioned before, it is fenced. Along here, it would be a visual barrier. Along here, it may be a split rail type fence. All access ways vehicularly will be handled with a card access. There will be on-site security as well. The part of the site, and you mentioned lighting or asked about lighting, and the lighting would be a low-key type lighting, might be some tree-up lighting. Any direct lighting would be all shielded so that it stays within this property.
Thanks. That's all I had. DJ, if you could come forward. DJ, your credentials are in the record. If you'd introduce yourself.
DJ Hughes, an associate with Davis Bone and Friedel. Traffic engineer, did the traffic impact study.
For these two applications, did Del Dot require a traffic impact study?
For the application specifically, no. However, for site plan approval, we did do a TIS that was submitted on January 11th of this year.
Did you exchange correspondence with Del Dot about the requirement for a TIS for the applications?
Yes, we did.
And did Del Dot indicate that a TIS was not required?
Yes, in the correspondence on May 17, 2012, which I believe is in Exhibit 3 of the booklet, Del Dot did not require a TIS specifically for the rezoning or conditional use applications.
Has a TIS been prepared?
Yes, it was, and it was submitted in January 11th of this year.
Can you explain what the TIS recommends?
Yes, well, if I could back up for a second, the TIS addresses actually 628 RV lots and campsites, and the TIS recommends, if I can take you to the boards, I could probably show you.
Please do.
Okay, if we look, we've got it broken into two sections. Up top here is the Cedar Grove Road frontage, the area where our site access is located, about 2,000 feet from Mulberry Knoll Road. Starting about 550 feet, or maybe about 600 from the center line of this site access, we'll be providing 11-foot lanes and 5-foot shoulders on Cedar Grove Road, which meets the Del Dot local roadway standards. Currently, you've got about 10 to 11-foot lanes with no paved shoulders. The 11-foot shoulders, our 11-foot through lanes and 5-foot shoulders will continue beyond Mulberry Knoll Road up to a point where they'll join with the Delta project that is slated to start in the spring of 2014 to realign Cedar Grove Road opposite Postal Lane and signalize and improve that intersection. With respect to our site access itself, we will have a 310-foot left turn lane that will accommodate RVs and be designed with turning templates to make sure that the radius are adequate to serve RVs.
When do you anticipate a response to the TIS from DLDOT?
Typically, they take about 60 days, sometimes it's longer, depending on how complex the recommendations are.
You referenced the timetable that DLDOT has for the improvements to Postal Lane. When is that?
They're supposed to start in the spring of 2014 with completion in 2015, so they may not be completely opened until 2015 or into 2016.
But that is the long-awaited realignment of Postal Lane?
Yes, that is the realignment of Cedar Grove Road opposite Postal Lane, the signalization of Plantation Road, Cedar Grove Road, and Postal Lane, and also providing exclusive lanes for all approaches and bike lanes as well.
Have you had any communications with the people at DART about this project?
Yes, we have. And basically, DART is willing to, they have, well, the backup, they have two routes. One is a seasonal, existing seasonal route, 207, that travels between 24 and Long Neck. And the other is a planned year-round route that will run between Route 24, between Route 1 and Millsboro. DART has agreed that this is a good site that's a candidate for a stop, and they've actually agreed to come into to look into coming into our welcome center and being accommodated with a bus stop on site.
Has DART indicated that it has had any experience with campgrounds or RV parks in the past?
Yes, they did. In talking with them, they referenced the Three Seasons campground that was formerly in service, and they noted that it had about a ridership of 10 to 15 people every 10 minutes throughout the day.
So it was very busy?
Yes, that's a very busy. That's about 60 to 90 people that it was carrying an hour.
Mm-hmm. Has there been any subsequent communication between you and DLDOT after the Planning and Zoning Commission hearing about this project?
Yes, there have. There were several public comments that were received by DLDOT on record at TIS.
And those comments addressed your report or just criticized the traffic situation in general?
Most of the comments were not specific to the report, but were more general in nature, and DLDOT did respond to those, and DLDOT's aware of the scope of the project.
Mm-hmm. In any event, what DLDOT says is going to rule the day anyway.
That's correct. To obtain entrance approval, well, first we need a letter of no objection, then we need entrance approval, and to do that, DLDOT's going to make sure that we meet their requirements.
Thank you. Ed?
Thanks.
You could introduce yourself.
Excuse me. My name is Edward Lene. I'm a principal in Environmental Resources Incorporated, located in Selbyville, Delaware. I'm a environmental consultant primarily on regarding land use matters and natural resource matters with 34 years experience. I hold a degree in environmental science, management, planning, and wildlife biology. I'm a professional wetland scientist certified by the Society of Wetland Scientists.
I'm going to hand your credentials up to council. Ed, have you had an opportunity to review the record made at the planning and zoning hearing?
I have.
And have you prepared a report and some recommendations in that regard?
I have prepared a report and some design recommendations for future site plan consideration.
Can you summarize that report while I hand it out?
Sure. I guess my role, I've had a couple different roles on the project. One, I've been responsible for the delineation of the state and federal wetlands on the property, and I'd like to go through a breakdown of the acreages that are shown on the various boards and go through buffers and so forth. I've also been charged with contacting state and federal agencies regarding records regarding
rare and threatened species, and I want to talk about that and some other resource issues in my discussion. As mentioned earlier, the total site being considered today is 160.42 acres. Of that amount, there's approximately 113 acres of forested wetland, forested uplands, 13 acres of agricultural field, and there's also an abandoned dredge spoil site approximate to the shoreline of Love Creek in the upland area that was used a number of years ago by DENREC for dredging of the creek, and that's about 6 acres in size. So that totals up to about 132.05 acres of the site that is uplands. In regard to wetlands on the property, we have some DENREC and federally regulated salt marshes, which are basically shown in the brownish color bordering the creek and that other tributary that you see extending into the site is actually known as Hetty Fisher's Glade. So that the lower part of that is actually a tidally flowed water body. And then in addition, there's some federally regulated and state regulated scrub shrub and forested wetlands, you know, totaling a little over 4 acres. The remaining wetlands on the site that are regulated are federally regulated non-tidal wetlands that are associated with the headwaters of the Hetty Fisher Glade and unnamed tributary that extends up towards Ward Road. And basically, there's a narrow stream channels, some of which, as they get to the upper extent, don't have perennial flow. And there's basically a pretty well-defined narrow area of wetlands that borders these channels, and then there's a slope, and basically the uplands on the property actually is pretty well elevated in relation to the wetlands, more or less like up on a plateau-like situation. The other wetland area I wanted to mention is Welch's Pond, and that's that blue area that you could see kind of opposite where the coastal towing and maintenance property is mentioned, was previously mentioned. And that is not a state-regulated wetland, and furthermore, it's not a federally regulated wetland because it's separated, it's isolated from any downstream navigable waters, which is one of the tests of what the federal government regulates.
It's so perfectly round, do you think it's man-made?
No, I think that's a natural, feature. Now, I'll talk about that a little more. So in total, when we look at all that, there's about 30.37 acres of wetlands on the site, both regulated and unregulated. Welch's Pond is about 7.34 acres. And essentially, you know, I performed a wetlands delineation. The delineation that I've done is pretty turned out to be very consistent with both the state statewide area mapping project known as the SWAMPS maps. That's their resource map. It's very well consistent with the USDA Soil Survey, as well as the National, the Fish and Wildlife Service National Wetlands Inventory maps. What I wanted to, I think a very important thing to note about the site is, again, I mentioned the soil survey maps, and that soil survey is included in one of the exhibits in my report. That's the official USDA soil survey for Sussex County. And basically, within the upland area, it maps soil series known as Downer, Fort Mott, Greenwich, Hamilton, Ingleside, Piney Neck, and Rosedale. And as a group, those soils are probably some of the most well-drained, with fewest limitations for development that we find in the county. They're outside of floodplain areas. They have an excellent separation between existing local groundwater tables and the soil surface. So they're very well capable of doing an excellent job in meeting TMDL's stormwater management requirements and you know, other development considerations. So looking at that soil, those soil types, that those compose, again, about 81% of the project site. The poorly drained or soils on the property are in the Broadkill, Long Marsh, Mullica, and Manahawkin series. And pretty much those soil types are all confined to the areas that I've delineated as wetlands on the property. One other feature I'm going to talk about a little more depth, but I wanted to note that one unique feature of the site is there is actually a natural landing on the property where an upland area actually comes and touches the waters of Love Creek, which obviously makes an ideal place, and that's where the canoe kayak launch is going to be situated. And
Excuse me, can you take the mic, please? We have people watching on the internet, too, so they can hear.
And that area is located right here, and basically on this map, basically you can see that this is that upland area right here that touches directly upon the creek. Thanks. The other thing I wanted to touch upon, we have the buffer map up there, and I wanted to just go through the buffer requirements and basically talk about how the site, through the voluntary buffers being provided, exceeds any applicable standards. There are no state and federal requirements for buffers from wetlands, and most developments provide a minimum buffer, you know, that comes from the county code. And I think you're probably aware that the county requires a buffer from state-mapped wetlands, essentially tidal wetlands, of 50 feet or the mean high water line, whichever is greater, and 50 feet from the ordinary water mark of a perennial stream. In the case of this project, we're voluntarily going to expand that to, rather than measuring it from those bordering those features, is generally non-tidal wetlands. So we're going to provide a 50-foot buffer voluntarily from all non-tidal wetland boundaries. That's going to be much more inclusive than any, you know, most projects the county ever sees or what gets approved. You know, nearby projects, the Retreat, Love Creek, so forth, basically only had a 50-foot buffer, again, from state tidal wetlands. We're also going to provide, even though it's unregulated, and I'll get to that in a little more detail, some significant buffering around Welch's Pond. In terms of navigation, again, I pointed out the location where the natural landing on the site occurs. There's good water depths for the type of facility that we're talking about, limited canoes and kayaks. There's no records of submerged or aquatic vegetation at that area. The creek at that point is 265 feet wide. You know, in terms of navigational issues, I wanted to point out that between the Love Creek Bridge over 24 and Robinsonville Road, there's approximately 25 private residential docks. All but five of those docks are actually upstream of this facility. So I have some pictures, Mike, if you might show. I think many are familiar with some of the canoe kayak facilities that are in the county that the Department of Parks and Recreation has done. They commonly use a product similar to this. This is a Gator dock product. It has a dedicated launch to be able to pull a canoe or kayak in and safely basically launch, stand up, enter and exit the boat. That's the type of facility that we're going to be proposing here, that same general concept. I wanted to point out that everything will be in accordance. I'll be getting a permit from DENREC and the Corps of Engineers for that facility. Everything will be in accordance with their design standards. And I would point out, with the width of that creek, the dock would not extend any more than 50 feet out from the shoreline. I guess moving on, I wanted to, and the other thing I wanted to kind of note, which I think is important on the buffer board, Mike, if you could There's on photo 9, that's actually looking from the uplands across the creek at the point that the dock would be located. And then the photo next to that is actually looking down creek. You can actually see down to the Boat Hole Marina and so forth. That's a pretty navigable stretch of water. The I guess the next topic I wanted to touch upon was some of the wildlife considerations and some of the reports that, you know, we've got through contacting the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Denrec in regard to their records. Just for the record, I wanted to say that there are no bald eagle nests on the property. There are no rookeries for herons, egrets, and those type of colonial nesting bird species on the property. There's obviously, you know, those species of herons and egrets will obviously lose the tidal salt marshes as a place to eat and forage. And again, we have no impacts proposed on any of those type of wetlands as part of the project. There are no federally listed threatened endangered species or critical habitats on the property, as verified by letters that we've received from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. There are, however, three species of amphibians, the eastern tiger salamander, copes, gray tree frog, and the barking tree frog, which are rare to the state of Delaware. And those three species, as part of their life cycle, require a seasonal pond. And essentially, a seasonal pond that dries, and that's an environment that gets dry and gets wet, and is generally a fishless environment. So where that occurs is actually Welch's Pond. And basically, Denrec has records of those three species occurring in that in Welch's Pond. And as I mentioned, I'm going to get into some design recommendations where we're going to provide some buffering. And basically, there we're going to have buffers, and there really isn't going to be any, we're not going to propose any development activity in and around the pond, and I'll get to that in more detail.
What would be in the buffers? What kind of buffers?
The buffers are going to just be wooded.
The woods
will remain.
Buffers around all waters are being, how about the ones around the creek itself? Will that be vegetated in any way, any kind of vegetation?
Well, pretty much all the buffers are wooded now, so it would be preserved. Like along Love Creek, actually, you could see the brown color is the tidal salt marsh. The yellow color, I should put out that yellower color, mm-hmm. is the wooded wetlands. So, mm-hmm. and then landward of the wooded wetlands is the green 50-foot buffer of upland forest that will be mm-hmm. retained. Mm-hmm. So it's, the nice thing is along Love Creek, actually, if you look at that, the width of the buffer is, you know, between 200 and 400 feet wide, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of any development from the buffer. So that's a very, you know, generous for screening and environmental issues to have that wooded wetlands bordering natural waters itself.
So you're not going to thin it out. You're not going for views no. or anything
How
like that.
How do you
that.
Access
it's gonna be,
it?
It's going to be remained
access.
I mean, well, yeah, it was just the same thing as George was asking. I mean, what kind of access would you have there?
People, you know, it's a wooded environment. I mean, it's nice to walk through. So I would imagine there'll be people that will
Trails.
Walk through it, but not
to the water.
Right. No, there'll be one point of access to the water, and again, that's the landing area.
At the point.
Right.
That's it.
That's it.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt, but I heard that buffer a number of times.
I guess in regard to some of the comment letters kind of received in regard to Welch's Pond, you know, I guess I'd have to characterize those letters as really maybe not recognizing the environmental setting of the pond itself. And, you know, essentially, I think you could read a lot of the comment letters and come away with an idea that the pond itself was a very pristine, beautiful environment. And I'd like to show you a couple things, I guess, in that regard. Mike, if you could go to the first set of photos. So a couple things about the pond, at least three, we'll talk about three sides of the pond. And, you know, essentially the property that borders the pond is the is a coastal towing and repair operation, and that's a, you know, a car repair and a tow yard. And essentially, you can see the frontage in photo 3 and the rear of the building in photo 4. You could skip real quick, Mike, to the next set of photos. That's a picture of the back of the tow yard. And as you can see on the site plan, there's maybe 50 to 80 feet of woods from the back of the tow yard to Welsh's Pond. And, you know, essentially, I could go through those four photographs in great detail, but they're taken all across the back property line. And I guess the point of that, I've looked at the tow yard. There isn't any stormwater management there. And essentially, I would say, with looking at the grade of the land, probably 80 to 90% of the entire tow yard actually drains directly into Welsh's Pond. You could see actually the flow paths and the channels cut down on those three photographs. And then basically, just to give an idea of scale, from photograph 7 to photograph 8 is that's me standing in between the pond itself and the tow yard so that you can see how close, in fact, it really is.
Is there any open water on that pond?
There, in the winter months, there's open water. And in the summer months, because that's what makes it available habitat for these species, it actually dries down. Okay. It's those... again, they're looking for a fishless environment, it's a situation where it's like a vernal pool. It's wet sometimes, and in the summer it dries down. Right. And really, because the rest of the site is so well drained, and then the other wetlands on the site are connected to stream channels. That's really the available habitat where this rare species is of concern. And again, it's a rare species in the state of Delaware. It's globally secure. And part of the reason it's rare is that we're on the every species has a range in terms of temperature and habitats it lives in, and Delaware is on the outer part of the range of those species, and that's one of the reasons it's rare.
And what's the vegetation surrounding Welch's Pond?
I'd also point out, I guess in some comment letters that we recently received from DENREC, I mean, they note that the pond is degraded by Phragmites, which is also the case. And if you look on, again, photograph 6, which is behind coastal towing, and then basically there's two photographs I took looking kind of to the south and to the north from the easterly side of the pond, you can see that pretty much the entire pond is ringed with a pretty heavily growth of Phragmites, which is an indication of a disturbed habitat.
Phragmites is?
Phragmites, yeah, or common reed. I think probably now I'd like to kind of segue into... again, you know, in recognition that, you know, this is a concern. These are state rare species, and it is a concern that there's been a few things that I've proffered in regard to development in terms of development recommendations that I've discussed with Mr. Lingo, and I believe that they are going to, you know, adopt in the future site plan. So one of the things is currently on the, if you could get the site plan up, Mike. Site, maybe both, yeah, but I think more the site plan. Currently on the buffer board, they had proposed a 50-foot buffer around the pond from non-tidal wetlands on the current plan. And really, that's probably because there needs to be some available habitat for these species. Once they breed, they basically go into forested areas and live out the rest of their life cycle in a forested area. So that we need to preserve some available habitat around the pond. You know, essentially, if looking at the aerial photograph, you could see that there's just on the two sides of the pond, there's just a ring of trees. And essentially, on the kind of that northerly side as the entrance would come in, a lot of that is actually pretty well disturbed when you go out and look at it in the field. So my recommendations are this, that along that edge of the pond, that there we would provide a 100-foot buffer there. Then as you turned into the field, basically all that existing wooded there between the pond and the field edge would be retained. So, you know, that essentially is a 150-foot buffer. When you look at the site plan, there was a couple sites, there was actually the ring road that got mentioned between coastal towing and the pond. That's going to be eliminated, as you previously heard. There was a tent camping site also. That's going to be eliminated. And then basically on the other edge of that pond, it would be the easterly side of the pond. We're going to maintain at least 100-foot buffer from non-tidal wetlands there. And essentially what will happen then, if you could visualize, is that as you get up to where the stream channel and existing little, that's kind of the an intermittent stream headwater of the unnamed tributary, that's going to have a 50-foot buffer. That ties in to the wooded buffer that's going to be along Ward Road. So essentially, we're going to preserve all the woods kind of around the pond, take that road out, take the campground out. Essentially, that's going to preserve a wooded corridor, essentially a wildlife corridor that's going to preserve some available habitat for these species.
Who's that road belong to now, Ward Road?
That's a county road.
It is a state road.
Yeah, it's a state road. Okay, so you said you suggested those things.
Yeah, I've suggested them. I've gone over them with Mr. Lingo, and they're more than willing to follow these recommendations.
And these are things that they would be agreeable to putting into conditions. These are all this presentation is. These
Mr.
are things
Hammonds
that
can speak to that.
These are things that you are saying you would agree to. That I'm not want to understand the whole situation.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. We will agree to all of what Mr. Linnaeus just stated.
Okay, and then and in addition with the extra protection you're talking about would be included in that.
Right.
And we would see that in writing somewhere.
Okay. When the site plan is revised, we will remove those and add the additional buffer.
I have, I guess, one other, which I feel is a very kind of significant and important recommendation. And right now, the other, can we, so what may happen is we actually may lose that other road crossing up near Welsh's Pond. That'll either be relocated or possibly eliminated. Let me go to the board.
The other thing we've looked carefully at is this road crossing right here. And as you can see, it's a pretty wide area of wetlands that would cross. And it actually, as proposed now, it actually crosses the state regulus and DENREC regulated land. And because of the width of that crossing, the magnitude of that crossing, there's really better alternatives for siting that crossing. And so we're going to, on a future site, this will be moved. Essentially 1,000 feet to, and this is something that I've carefully reviewed in the field. The best place environmentally to probably put the road crossing would be right here. So essentially we're going to take this away and this road system will be modified so that the crossing will be here and then kind of come into the site and probably work with the site plan that it is now. So, you know, that again will minimize, that'll be a very small impact. We'll have to get the appropriate permit from the Corps of Engineers. Depending on how we construct it, we probably will not need a permit from DENREC to put the road crossing there because we will, at that point, span the channel. You know, the stream channel itself will be an arch. So we're not going to do any work in the channel itself. There'll probably be some minor non-tidal wetland impact associated, but again, we'll get that authorized through the Corps of Engineers, and if there needs to be some on-site mitigation to compensate for that, that'll be provided. On-site mitigation.
Thank you.
Okay.
The last thing is just a small thing, but I've talked to them about the stormwater ponds that are going to be on the site, and just in terms of some good recommendations to reduce problem with geese and to basically provide habitat and to enhance stormwater. We're going to limit the ponds to particular points of access where somebody might fish from a platform or a little landing area, and for the most part, keep a native grass buffer, no-mow buffer around the pond, which would just be seasonally mowed and maintained. As you see, a lot of it's the right way to do things, and you see that on a lot of the subdivisions through the county now, and you know, that's the way things are trending. It makes, I think, an attractive pond. It really reduces any geese problems because they don't like to go in and out of that no-mow area, so it provides a natural control. So that's going to be basically adopted as well. I guess I'll make a real quick summary of, again, some of the points that I made, but one thing I was going to mention was that Mr. Lank mentioned that the DENREC, actually Secretary O'Mara, sent a letter in regard to the project. And basically, it seemed like a lot of the letter was, you know, focused toward Welch's Pond, but then in I guess what I at least personally characterize as somewhat of an overreach, despite, you know, the fact of the things that the owners might be do right, and despite the fact that there's a tremendous amount of timberland that could be harvested on the site and so forth, he recommended preservation, whatever that means, for the property.
The whole thing?
Yeah. Okay. And I'd like to point out that Secretary O'Mara, through the Department of Parks and Recreation, is actually one of the largest campground operators in the state of Delaware. They operate Cape Henelopen, Delaware Seashore Inlet, Trap Pond State Park, Killens Pond State Park, and Lums Pond State Park. Each of those state parks is probably more environmentally sensitive, one as compared to the other, and certainly just as environmentally sensitive as this site. There's RV sites, there's cabins, and there's tents, and there's amenities offered using and making use of for the users of the park of the natural resources on the site. Trap Pond, which is very close to us in particular, hosts a very unique bald cypress swamp environment, RV sites, tent sites, and campsites at that site. I'd like to show a picture of Delaware Seashore Inlet State Park. And basically, there's 148 RV sites that the department operates there and 32 tent sites at that location. Here's kind of a picture of the southerly part of that. If you visit that, you'd be surprised to find that in terms of environmental buffers, this is basically bordering and draining directly into the inland bays. There are no buffers, little or no, and there is absolutely no stormwater management. That picture, photo number 12, is basically, you see a gravelly area in the background and some silt fence. That's basically the flow path for the entire southerly part of their RV campground site.
Well, evidently, I guess they're trying to do right now.
Well, I would offer that, you know, we have that, again, with the voluntary buffers, that we're going to exceed every county standard in terms of buffering. We've completely avoided tidal wetlands. Just with the exception of the one minor or two minor road crossings, are completely avoiding any non-tidal wetlands impacts. As I mentioned, 81% of the site is some of the finest, most developable soils in the county. So, you know, as far as
being
in terms of development limitations, in terms of, well, for houses or for really any use, because, you know, again,
but it drains well.
We're outside of a floodplain. We have excellent, all those soil types I mentioned have excellent separation between the land surface and the groundwater. So You have a lot of capability for treatment of stormwater as it percolates in the ground. So it's, you know, this is really a very unique site, and you know, it lends itself, could lend itself to houses as well as, you know, a campground use.
Is it Love Creek swimmable and fishable?
I would say where this site is, actually, it's a very sandy bottom. When you actually go to that landing, you can actually walk out, and it's not a, else, I would say that when you want go elsewhere in the creek, you'd be probably stepping off into some mud. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in terms of this being a great shallow swimming hole site, yeah, shallow. It's shallow, but I can tell you, you know, I've been up certainly canoeing kayaks for the things we're talking about is just fine. And again, I wanted to point out, if it wasn't navigable, there wouldn't be 25 docks between SR 24 and Robinsonville Road. And I pointed out there's more than 20 docks that are north of this site. So in terms of the light type of recreational use that we're talking about, you know, this is more than suitable.
Could you, before you quit, Ed, could you weigh or just go through the state recommendations and your recommendations and where they differ? Don't have to elaborate, just so I don't have to go through both reports and try to figure out what the differences are.
You could
quickly tell
me. Well, you could look at, again, you know, Secretary O'Mara thought that the entire site just should, right. But he attached, the best thing to read is there's actually an attachment, which is a reiteration of two other sets of comments. I contacted them at the beginning of the project and got a set of comments, and it mentioned the pond. And they also, which I think is a very unfair characterization of the site, in their letters, they talk about myriads of wetlands all over the place. And you would read the letter, and you would believe that this was just intertwined, and there was, you know, wetlands all over the place and whatever. And as you can see, it's not the case.
Well, I think that referenced the whole natural area, not just the site.
Right.
That, I mean, there's a number of wetlands all through that Love Creek natural area, whatever we call it.
Right. That's fair enough.
Right. I don't think he was saying that site had 1,000.
Well, you and I might differ, I think.
Well, your interpretation helps you and the other interpretation. Yeah.
So, I got to get back to your question.
Right. Oh, I was, the differences between your report and the recommendations of PLOS.
So,
just real quick and don't elaborate.
So the Natural Heritage Group in the last letter actually talked about some distances in terms of buffers.
Okay.
Not really recommending anything. As you know, they usually recommend a 100-foot buffer or up to a 300-foot buffer, and we're kind of doing that. They talked about literature, and they talked about how far, if one of these amphibians was in the pond, how far might the literature say, could you surmise that it might travel and utilize existing forest areas? Not that even with a campground, they'll still be, you know, they're not proposing to clear cut this thing. Mm-hmm. And again, we're providing a corridor. So that buffer distance, if you look at there, they give it in meters, but it basically boils down to 400 to 800 feet. So that they would like ultimately to see a 400 to 800 foot buffer around Welch's Pond. But as I pointed out, you know, that's really only available on one side. And, mm-hmm. and you know, again, I think you have to consider the setting of the pond itself. I mean, you've seen the pictures
right.
as well as I. So I guess that concludes.
The big difference is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. I salute you, Ed, for not saying anything about Secretary O'Mara saying do as we say, not do as we do. With that, Nick, could you come up? Nick, earlier you identified yourself as a licensed Delaware realtor. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I'm going to ask you to express your opinion on whether this project will have any negative impact on property values in the area.
I do not believe it will have any negative impact whatsoever on property values in the area.
Could we have order in the room, please? Order.
Well, stay in the room, please. Keep quiet.
I think if history tells us anything, you look at a property like Rehoboth Beach Yacht and Country Club. In 1978, when the Three Seasons Campground opened, there were roughly 100 homes in Rehoboth Beach Yacht and Country Club. When it closed in 2006, it was close to fully developed at almost 900 homes, and I think anybody that understands that area and the property values in that area and how they increased over time would echo that property values there were not affected. You look at a RV park down in the Dagsboro area called Tuckahoe Acres. You have Bay Forest just a mile away, which is arguably the best-selling community in Sussex County. You look at Holly Acres, several residential subdivisions in that area, including Baywater, Stonewater Creek, and it's immediately surrounded by homes. You look down in Fenwick at Treasure Beach and the several new home developments that have sprung up over the years since Treasure Beach was developed. So I could go on with multiple examples, but I think it's a pretty well-supported opinion that that property values will not be negatively impacted.
I don't get it. So you're saying that if you build RV park, it will not deteriorate, it will not decrease the value of the land because then they have become homesteads or residential communities. So why not just have the residential community?
Oh, I'm simply stating that I
follow your
logic. No, I'm simply stating that development in and around campgrounds and RV parks has occurred in the past, and it has not negatively impacted property values in and around.
Why did
sites.
They close the RV parks and build homes?
Because they got quite a bit of.
In 2006, I'll explain that to you, Mr. Stever, when I close.
I don't get your logic, so I'm trying to understand how.
I think that what Mr. Hammonds has said is that the two can peacefully coexist and have peacefully coexisted.
Well, they closed down the Three Seasons, right? Not a coexistence.
It was a very large dollar amount associated with closing down the Three Seasons.
I'll explain the circumstances, Mrs. Stevens.
Oh, okay.
And lastly, I'd argue that the current landowner, J.G. Townsend, owns much of the adjoining land in and around this site in the Route 24 corridor. So if we or they thought that in any way this would negatively impact property values, it would not be smart for us to develop it in the manner that we have proposed.
Thanks. The hour is getting late and we've gone on too long, but I will close quickly. Thank you. You have before you an avalanche of emails, letters, and petitions opposing this application. As you've been reminded on a number of occasions, it's a good thing that land use decisions are not popularity contests. If that were the case, Three Seasons never would have happened. That application in 1978 was met with a volume of opposition in letter form and vocal opposition from Rehoboth Beach Country Club. No one spoke in support, but that application was approved. You'll remember the application of Nanticoke Shores in 2011 for mobile home community, for an RV park within a mobile home community in Long Neck. That was hotly opposed not only by residents of nearby mobile home communities, but by the Delaware Manufactured Housing Association. There was a volume of correspondence in opposition, petitions, and several dozen people spoke at the public hearing in opposition. No one spoke in support. Council approved that application in May 2011. For that matter, in 2003, the retreat at Love Creek was the subject of a volume of letters in opposition and vocal opposition from people you'll hear from today at both public hearings. The Department of Agriculture recommended denial of that application because of its proximity to an agricultural preservation district. Again, no one spoke in support. Council approved that application in May of 2003. Again, if land use decisions were a popularity contest, Three Seasons wouldn't have existed, and the retreat at Love Creek would not exist today. Just as the RV parks and campgrounds Nick described have peacefully coexisted with nearby and adjoining properties without negative impact on the environment or property values, the result will be the same here. With the open space preserved, with the forest stand preserved, with the applicant's emphasis on voluntary buffers and mandatory setbacks, most of which would be lost by a by right subdivision, this project will have substantially less impact on area infrastructure, area roads. Sewer will be paid for by the applicant. Water will be paid for by the applicant. And certainly there'll be no impact on schools. Project is consistent with the county's comprehensive plan since it promotes two things, tourism and economic development. It complies with County Ordinance 115-172, and it complies with the requirements of the county's environmentally sensitive developing district overlay zone. It is in level 2 and 3 on the state strategies map, where the state will make infrastructure investments, and it's certainly more gentle and less impactive on the environment than a residential subdivision. Going back in time, 35 years ago, I presented the Three Seasons application to council. That application was met with the ultimate not in my backyard opposition for one reason. It was in Rehoboth Beach Country Club's backyard. It was the adjoining property. The project was developed and existed and flourished in harmony with Rehoboth Beach Country Club until it was closed in 2006. The owner decided to retire. He and his wife were offered an 8-digit number for that property, not more than 32 acres. The purchaser came back to the county in 2006 with an application for MRRPC residential plan community of 132 lots. Ironically, the residents of Rehoboth Beach Country Club appeared and opposed that application. Their argument? A 132-lot subdivision generates more traffic than a 320-lot campground. As you know, and Mrs. Deaver in particular, tourism is the lifeblood of Lewis and Rehoboth Hundred. It's an important part of the county's comprehensive plan since it drives the local economy. In the short term, people come here to vacation. In the long term, those same people fall in love with the area and they buy property or they buy homes and they build, they relocate, and they settle here. As I pointed out earlier, within a radius of a mile, there are at least 900 lots on the drawing board. Whether they go forward to development, I can't say. What I can say is Sussex County will continue to grow, and so will Lewis Rehoboth Hundred. The short and long-term benefits of this project to the economy and the county's growth are obvious. As it is designed, its impacts will be minimal, and when built in three phases, it will blend in the area just as every other RV park we've talked about today has done over the last 40 years. We'd be glad to field any questions you have.
Thank you, and I don't think you took too long.
I know a lot of people do.
I want to recap one thing. What kind of improvements is the applicant going to make on roads? I know that DelDOT's going to reconfigure the intersection at Postal Lane, but what is, I heard some offers from the...
It's not offers. This was Mr. Hughes' traffic...
Just let me know what
traffic
it was.
Damned if I can tell you, but Mr. Hughes will. It is what the traffic impacts study generated. DelDOT will ultimately determine what improvements must be made. But, DJ, if you could explain again what improvements the developer...
You're going to widen the road. You're going to put shoulders on...
Yes. Today it's about a 10, maybe 10.5-foot travel lane in each direction. So you got maybe 21-foot wide road.
Mm-hmm.
There's no paved shoulder. So, for example, if you're a bicyclist today, you're riding in the through lane in
you
cars.
You can't even pull over.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what we're proposing and have talked and discussed with DelDOT is 11-foot lanes in each direction, 5-foot shoulders.
Uh-huh.
So paved shoulders. Uh-huh. And that will go from the extent of our site access construction, and it will meet the DelDOT project limits for the realignment of Cedar Grove Road opposite Postal Lane.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're done and DelDOT are done, and the project schedules at this time are very similar and kind of in tune with each other, you would have a continuous 11-foot lane, 5-foot shoulder in each direction from our site access all the way up to Plantation Road.
Well, doesn't the applicant own the land on either side of that road anyway?
I don't know if they own it entirely on each side,
but
they
might.
Well,
I just was wondering. Anyway, so the road is you're saying that the lanes are now 10 feet wide. You would make them 11 feet wide?
Yes. Currently, the road doesn't meet DLDOT standards today. Like, if we don't do anything, if we stay at Farmfield, it doesn't meet the standards today.
So the road would still be just 22 feet wide? Have I got that right?
The local roadway standards are 11-foot lane and a 5-foot shoulder in each direction, which is...
I thought 30 feet was a...
Well, when you get done, you will have 32 feet of paved area. Right now, you've got about 20 to 21. So your total widening in each direction will be about 10 to 11 feet.
But it would be a paved shoulder?
Yes.
Paved?
Yes.
How many feet are you doing? How many feet back are you talking about?
Are you talking about length or width?
DLDOT's going to increase the width of part of the intersection. Are you talking about from there back to your spot?
Yes, DLDOT is widening the intersection.
The Grove Road.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they're providing turn lanes and through lanes and bike lanes for the intersection with a signal.
Correct.
As you come back from the signal towards our site,
yes,
when you depart that intersection, you have a basically 32-foot road section.
Right.
And from the center line to the edge of the pavement on each side will consist of 16 feet, which is an 11-foot through lane and a 5-foot paved shoulder that can be used by bicyclists.
Back all the way back to your
correct. Property. It goes all the way back just about to the area of coastal towing, and then our site access where we do a left turn lane, there'll be a 5-foot dedicated bike lane that has the bike stripes on the pavement as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and no other improvements on any other intersections at all.
As of this time, by the developer, no. DLDOT has programmed improvements in the CTP for 24 and Mulberry Knoll Road. Exclusive lanes are being provided on Route 24, including bike lanes. So you'll have a left, a through, and a right in each direction at Mulberry Knoll Road and Route 24.
You know I live right there, don't you?
Yes, I do.
And you know how long we've been waiting for that. And we're going to have to wait a long time for those.
I believe the current schedule is advertised for construction November 2014. I don't want to speak for them, but typically if it was going to be advertised in the fall, I'd assume it would start spring of 2015.
Really? 2015?
Yes, and it is programmed in their six-year CTP.
Uh-huh.
And I believe Ms. Barnhart, if I'm correct, was down here not too long ago speaking to some of these projects.
She talked about that 2014. She talked about postal lane realignment, but nothing else in that area that I recall. I could be wrong. You know, but I'll go back and look at the notes.
Yeah,
but,
yes, and actually in the TIS, we have that as part of the correspondence, and there's actually a DLDOT projects section.
It's been mentioned, but I want to know what the applicant is offering to do.
Well, the TIS comments have not come back. I can tell you what we're proposing. I can tell you what DLDOT's proposing. But until we get a final TIS letter recommendation from DLDOT, I really can't speak to what everything that is going to be required is.
Well, that's what I'm looking at. You know, who's going to contribute what?
Well, we will find that out, Mrs. Deaver, when DLDOT has responded with its comments to the TIS.
Got you.
And that should be somewhere around March 15, is that correct?
Yeah, the TIS was submitted on January 11th, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong, Lawrence, they try to maintain a 60.
You don't need that to make an offer to widen a road, do you?
Well, the TIS does a lot more than just making an offer to widen a road.
You people would widen a road.
That's what our TIS report said.
Mm-hmm.
What we showed is what we're proposing to do.
I'm just clarifying what kind of road, how wide, how far. That's all that the applicant's going to pay for.
Correct.
Okay.
Ultimately, that will be decided by DLDOT if it has additional requirements.
Well, maybe DLDOT will pay for it, is what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that at all.
I can assure you they will not.
DLDOT doesn't pay for much of anything these days, as developers have come to know. What DLDOT may say is there are additional road improvements that will be required.
Required. Oh, in addition to that.
Yes.
Well, that's aside from what I'm asking. Right. So, but I think you answered me. Thank you very much.
I was under the impression when you said 10 feet. I thought you meant 10 feet added on to the existing road.
No.
You're talking about 5 foot added
on either
to
the side.
The existing roadway, if you go from the edge of pave where the grass starts on one side to the edge of pave where the grass starts on the other, is about 21 feet. When we are done, you will have a 32 feet wide road with pavement from one edge of grass to the other edge of grass.
Okay, that's only for one side. What's the width going to be on one side?
On one side, it will be 16 feet from the center line, if you can picture the double yellow or the dashed center line with the yellow stripe. You'll go 16 foot on one side of that with 11 foot until you get to the white edge line stripe, and then another 5 foot until you reach the grass on each side.
But that would be enough for somebody to have to pull off the side, like the RVs. They're going to turn in?
Well, when...
Well, that's... Shouldn't they be go through right and then allow the traffic to go on by?
Yes, what you're talking about is the left turn lane. I can show you if you want, but we are...
We're going to have that, right?
We're going to propose a left turn lane, so if you're a through vehicle behind an RV, as they go to turn left in our site, you will be able to go around them unimpeded. There's a 550-foot transition area that allows that to occur.
Well, I understood it, but then I heard you talking 5 foot here and different widths, and I thought, well, this is not going to be enough for a turn lane here.
No, what you're talking about is at the site access. Okay. The 11s and 5s are outside of the site access.
Yeah. Is there a maximum length of these RVs? I mean, I've been seeing these on TV. They're huge, some of them. I mean,
We have turn-in templates where you can actually run the radius of the wheels, and you can see if they encroach on anything, then we have to widen the radius so that they're not running over.
But what about the other intersections?
Well, same thing at the intersections. Whenever you do turning lanes, you always want to make sure the turning radiuses are provided.
So there's no limit then on the size of the...
As far as the limit of what can come to the site, I mean, we're accommodating, you know, the latest and greatest RVs on
our site. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right.
Other questions? Mr. Cole.
Earlier, some of these campgrounds applications, we've looked at how many transient sites they'd have. Like, are they going to have some park? Are they going to permit park models? Or are they going to be seasonal sites? Are they going to be tents? Sounds like you eliminated tent sites. Are there going to be tent sites put back in? So could you give me a scenario of what – are there going to be any conditions that you're going to proffer later that'll break that down? Because we have in the past applied percentages to make sure that there is enough – a transient, you know, spot as opposed to three seasons, you pointed out, was 100% seasonal. Mm-hmm. That's why it had minimal impact, and it was 30 years ago. So it's hard to use that as an example for something today, 30 years later. So
closed 6 years ago, George.
But the concern is when you take a campground and turn it into something permanent, it's a different animal, with especially some of these park models or miniature mobile homes.
Mm-hmm. First of all, I'll let Mr. Hammonds answer that. I recall how fond you are of park models.
Well, it's an issue. I mean, they have pop-outs. Gene, you need to have a special permit to pull some of them.
To my knowledge, and Mr. Hammonds can confirm this, there is no plan for any park model on site, but I'll let him speak to it.
As far as the percentage goes, we want a predominantly seasonal campground for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that if you look at occupancies in seasonal campgrounds versus those in transient campgrounds, the seasonal campgrounds are far higher, far sooner.
Are you proffering as in any conditions at this point what percentages you'd like? Because we have the ability to put percentages in a conditional use.
I'd say no more than 20% would be.
Something Gene might want to make sure it's in writing somewhere.
The record, I presume, will be left open after today, Mr. Cole. We'd be glad to make that
sure
proffer.
But that's
I believe
area,
what Mr. Hammonds is saying is that 20% of the property would be set aside for transients.
Okay. I also noticed there was only five bathhouses. And if you've got 600 and some sites, what if everybody's got to go to the bathroom who had a big party one night? And it's 120 some, it's like 125 big units to each bathhouse?
That's why they're self-contained.
And you put three people in each one? That's a lot of people rushing to the bathroom. Is that going to handle that?
I can speak a little bit to that.
Because I'm getting older and I sometimes have to, you know. Whatever.
I understand completely.
I'm talking about Sam. It's Sam. Right. He's a bunch of
Now, keep in mind, many of the RVs will be equipped.
So there's a pump out station.
The bathhouses that you see intermittently through here, and there might need to be one added over here, are really for convenience. But also the clubhouses themselves.
It looks like a long walk for some of them.
They're there for exercise anyhow.
Especially in the middle of the night.
Each site does, we will be providing sewer, and each site will have an individual sewer hookup.
All right. I guess that's the answer.
Well, I've been reading, too, and I was reading that the RV people love to find dump sites. You're not going to have outside RVers coming in for your dump sites, are you? Speaking of...
I don't know how they'll get in.
Along the same lines here.
We will have... You know it will be gated access, so unless you have a reservation there, you're not going to be coming in and dumping anything.
Dumpers, okay.
No dumpers.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other questions from council? And seeing none, is there anyone else here today that would like to speak in favor of this application? Anyone else here today that would like to speak in favor? Let's see one person coming up. And give us your name and address, please.
My name is James Bardsley, and I live in at 5 Tanglewood and Briarwood Estates. And I have a brief paper here I put together. After attending the meeting of Wednesday, January 24th, 2013, in Georgetown, and the Briarwood meeting on Saturday, February 9th, it was clear to me that there were issues that I felt needed to be introduced. I am not an expert in the environmental concerns, traffic problems, or road conditions that should be addressed at that meeting. I feel that is the concern of the developer and all the appropriate federal, state, and county committees that will be involved with this project. However, my concerns are economical. While in attendance I heard of these meetings, I heard no mention of employment advantage or the economic impact and how much revenue would be brought into the community. My wife and I have been RVers for over 20 years. Our current RV is a fifth wheel, which is pulled by a truck, and it's over 40 feet long. We have RV'd extensively in destinations throughout the United States, including Alaska and Western Canada. RV resorts and campgrounds are different in some respects. RV resorts are normally destination places where families come on vacation, and these amenities that they have, such as swimming pools, Wi-Fi hookups, cable TV, mini golf, etc., is what they're looking for. This is what they expect at an RV resort, and that's why the rates reflect those amenities. And campgrounds, in many cases, offer less amenities at a lower rate. All RV resorts and campgrounds have quiet times and strict rules on noise and when extinguished campfires. There is usually a 24-hour security on all campgrounds and resorts to monitor those rules. What the developer at the RV resort Love Creek is doing is developing a high-end resort, which leads me to believe that there will be nothing detrimental to the area. My wife and I were both employed by the Three Seasons RV Resort in Rehoboth Beach, which bordered the country club. We were full-timers at that time, and at that time we were looking for a place to retire since moving from our previous home of 18 years in Alaska. Having family ties in the area, we chose Briarwood Estates. Now, the layout of the operations of Three Seasons were superb. In the building plans of this new resort, it seems that the most controversial issue is the traffic impact and the road conditions on Cedar Grove Road. Historically, Three Seasons operated from March the 15th through Thanksgiving weekend. The high concentration of traffic on Country Club Road was from July 1st through August the 20th, plus weekends. At no time was Country Club Road traffic impeded to stop and go because of campers entering or leaving the resort. Most all RV resorts that we have camped in are on secondary roads. A large parking facility for checking in the park at their welcoming centers. In addition to eliminating parking problems and traffic to and from Rehoboth, Three Seasons contracted with DART, and a bus would come into the park on a regular 7-day schedule, 10 a.m. to 11 p.m., to pick up beachgoers, shoppers, and people wanting to go into Rehoboth. The camp store sold the daily passes for a flat fee of $2.10 a day. I currently work on the economic basis. I currently work for a sports complex in Georgetown here. We have approximately 50,000 people visit us from mid-March to October, and it is estimated the money spent, these patrons, for hotels, food, rental homes, etc., And the plain enjoyment of the beach exceeds $20 to $30 million a year. In conclusion, there is a need for an RV resort in this area. I can tell you that when we travel, we keep running to previous campers from Three Seasons, and they all say the same thing. Why did they ever close that park? It is our belief and my belief, by developing the Love Creek RV Resort, it is going to buy a lot of joy and happiness for a whole new generation of campers and possibly future homeowners here in Sussex County. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to speak in favor of this application? Seeing none, we'll now hear from the opposition. And Ms. Scheider-Fox, if you'd come forward, I understand you are representing several homeowner associations and groups, and that you're going to be kind of coordinating many of them speaking.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
You know what I mean.
Need a break or anything for 5 minutes?
Won't we just stand up for a minute?
3 minute break or something?
I might want more
give
than
us a 3 minute break.
Good enough.
Seventh spot stretch.